Hello and welcome to Ask Matt. I'm Eugene Cordero, professor of meteorology and climate science at San Jose State and founder and director of Green Ninja. I'm here with Matt DeLasio, geology professor from Cal State Northridge, national NGSS expert, and one of the chief authors of the 2016 California Science Framework. The format of this podcast is that I ask Matt questions about science, science education, and NGSS, and we all learn more about science education and how to make this transition to NGSS easier and more rewarding for everyone. If you have any of your own questions, just send them to info@greenninja.org, and I'll share some of them with Matt in a future episode. So in today's episode, we have another special guest teacher. This is Elizabeth Brooking. Elizabeth has been teaching for 19 years, and after recently retiring from her school district, she felt an obligation to return to the classroom, especially in this COVID world that we're living in. She's now working at a very small independent charter school that wants to stay small. They have about 100 students in the school, and many of them need a lot of emotional and educational support. Most students and their families are Latinx, and the parents are the school board. So it's an interesting school. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Elizabeth, just to get started, can you tell us a little bit about your classroom environment, your students, the grade levels you teach? So what's all that look like for you right now?
Well, it looks like my living room. it's my first year at that school, and I've never been there, which is kind of strange. So I'm finding that I need to meet my students, try to get to know them as little boxes, if they're kind enough to show their faces. A lot of kids don't turn on their cameras, and it's very hard for them to talk. So I feel like I'm going blind sometimes, and it's a real struggle to try to get to know them and make a connection.
Gosh, I can empathize with that. And then, so which grades are you teaching, and how many students do you have?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So total about maybe 100. I'm teaching 6, 7, and 8.
Wow.
And part of what I love about it is that I'm able to teach the three different grades of Green Ninja, which is just an absolute delight. So I'm teaching three different grades, not too many sixth graders, about 40 or 50 seventh and then eighth graders. So it's been really interesting.
Yeah. And then are you teaching, is there synchronous and asynchronous pieces to that? Or how are you meeting with your students?
Well, I have, like many other schools, we're having a block that's Monday, Thursday, and Tuesday, Friday. So I meet with students only twice a week for almost an hour each time. And I really want students to be doing the work at that time with me. But not everyone shows up. Not everyone does the work with me. So it is my choice for them to be synchronous. Sometimes it's their choice or their need not to be.
Yeah. And, you know, so you've been in school probably about 8 weeks by now. Is that right?
Sorry, 8 week, right.
So if a parent or an administrator comes and says, Elizabeth, how's it going? How do you respond?
That's such a good question. Mixed. I would ideally love to reach out to every student and have them really understand what we're doing and being able to make a connection and they see how important this science is. That's my goal. What I'm getting to is more kids are participating and thinking it through. They're pretty shell-shocked, these kids, and it's really hard for them to even talk to each other. I'll let them go into what we call breakout rooms out of a Zoom meeting so they can work together. And instead, I go in and visit, and their screens are off, and they're not even talking.
I know.
They seem to have lost the ability to talk to people of their own age, and they know each other. It's rather shocking. And it's not just me with this issue. It's trying to drag them out. So, I mean, maybe they're afraid that they're not understanding it. I don't know. I just think everybody's been so isolated that it's very hard to get them encouraged to just speak to each other. We do a lot of text chat, you know, the chat box, but that takes more time. But if I'll go for that, I ask them to put their answers to communicate, but it's a real struggle. I am shocked, but, you know, somehow not surprised. It's been really awful for these kids. They've been so isolated and they're each in their own pod, really. So trying to get to teach with that background. So what I really like, certainly about Green Ninja, but also about NGSS, is that we're working on phenomena that I'm hoping that they can relate to that give them like, huh, I never thought of that. So just working on different types of rocks. And by the way, these kids really have no background in science. That's sort of been, there was a lot of turnover the past couple of years. So they really don't have a background. So it's not something, oh yeah, I remember we did that. So anything I can do and bring in to show them, but I miss being in a classroom for that. All the different little labs we could do. Kids don't have materials at home, really. And I just can't go out and, make 100 different drop-offs. They try to pick up things at school, but their parents are working. Our school is, has a person maybe Thursday and Fridays, but a lot of parents are working two or three jobs. There's just no easy way to get materials, and that is really a shame. So I'm always looking at ways to try to figure out like what's going to mean something to them, something they can do or notice. We have technology, but that's not the hands-on. So
Interesting.
I hope that gives some answers. So it's difficult. I really want them to be happy in what they're doing and have it build their excitement and imagination. It's hard. It's hard. So I'm working my best. I know everybody else is too.
Matt, Elizabeth mentioned, that she enjoys the NGSS aspect around phenomenon. You've been working with some teachers too, and do you hear the similar kind of some of the similar kind of challenges from the teachers that you're working with?
Yeah, so the sort of the excitement people have is when they find some sort of phenomena that really translates well to the online world, that has the excitement and the somehow it actually works, because as Elizabeth was saying, so many of our individual activities that we might do hands-on, we aren't doing, so we have to choose our phenomena using a slightly different criteria. And so it's really neat to find the ones that actually do make the lights go on in the kids and make them really light up.
So as a teacher, what I'll find is that I could easily use my little technology and find pictures right away, talking about different types of rock or Hawaii, which most kids have not been to. And they see the lava and they go, oh, okay. Just the ability at least to instantly show them what I want them to see and wonder about. And that's really nice.
Are they asking good questions, or is that still, are you trying to drag things out of them still when they see something really neat?
Some are dragging more easily. But if they see something that's super cool, that does help. They go, wow, I wonder what, so I've got to help them learn how to ask questions, certainly. It's not something they're used to, but I'm trying to elicit and the life experience. They're 12 years old, most of these kids, and have been inside for more than 6 months. You think about it. It's not doing them any favors. It's really hard for them. But they can go outside and grab a rock, for example. Most kids can. So you're looking at that kind of stuff.
Elizabeth, can you tell us how are parents involved in the learning process for your students? I'm sure there's different examples, but can you give us a little bit of a sense of what you're seeing, what you're experiencing?
Absolutely. Every parent always wants the best for their child. But many of these parents are working two or three jobs if they can. If they do have jobs, money's a problem. They're mostly immigrants, the kids are generally first generation. So we have a lot of translating tools. There's like ClassDojo or different things that parents, when they understand, can go and sign up and get a translation. This is an ongoing problem. And some people, they have to change phones, they change houses, they have lots of people living in one house. It's a huge challenge to get your student in a nice, comfortable place with a hotspot rearranged, but being able to focus on the work. It is a challenge for parents. They want the best, but they cannot always be sitting next to their student, which sometimes their student really needs. So parents are counting on the school to reach out to them. And I honestly don't think I'm doing a good enough job or my school. We try. But parents, they are so overwhelmed. There's one teacher at our school who has a kid who's in our class, and she's dealing with that too. And that's her own kid. It is not easy to have a kid at home and you working. It's really hard.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And those are big challenges. Can you explain, just for some of our folks, ClassDojo and why that's helpful?
Yeah, there are different programs that at the basic level are free to teachers and schools. Class Dojo has been around for a long time, and it enables a parent or family to sign up, and they can choose how they want to receive messages from the teacher or the school. They can have it translated and sent to them, in this case, usually Spanish, either by email. And most people don't have emails, but they do have phones that received a text message. But they have to know about it and be organized enough to sign up. And a lot of these parents are so stressed that even that's like one more thing. So they'd kind of like us to be able to take a bigger part in raising their children. I don't mind, you know, I understand. You know, we really need to be more of a family from a school point of view to help everybody out. It's really, we've got to work harder for this. It's really tough.
You know, you mentioned, so thanks for sharing that about mm-hmm. that tool. Are there things that your school has been trying to support teachers like yourself that seem to be helping?
Well, it's a very small school, so there's not this huge bureaucracy. There's not a huge administration staff, so everybody's doing extra. But we have a wonderful secretary who will call parents. She's bilingual, and that can help. That's really good. And I'm not bilingual, unfortunately. So we do get support, but it's still not enough. So we need to do more and inviting. Well, I guess we can't invite people in, but we had a back to school night and a lot of other schools have done this. But you know what? That parent has to have technology. They have to be around. They have to know how to use it to join a Zoom or whatever. So we at best reach maybe 1/4 of the parents. Mm-hmm. As technology right now is not their concern. It's putting food on the table, making sure their kids are okay and not in trouble. So it's really tough on them.
Do you get much opportunity to interact with other teachers in your school and kind of like, hey, what are you trying? Or like, how much interaction do you get on that opportunity?
Not, you know what? Not enough. And it's probably just me. You know, I'm new to this school. It's very small. But I do try to talk to other teachers I know who do teach science, and that helps a lot, and being involved with Green Ninja and Exploratorium, which has always given me great support. No, I don't think teachers communicate enough because they're busy doing other things. I got to tell you that in West Contra Costa, where I worked for my first 18 years, they've established a Friday day. Friday is just for teachers to work with each other and get training. It's not ideal. I hear a lot of complaints about it, but the idea is there. But all teachers I've ever met want more time to collaborate and plan. And there's never really enough time in regular hours.
Yeah, I've always thought that's one of our big limitations of our American education system is we just don't invest in that time for teachers to have adult time, if you will, mm-hmm. with other professionals. And really, there's so much potential and power in that. And I know that just some other countries really invest a lot more time, such that instead of having just one free period, prep period, you have two or even three. And those other ones are spent doing collaboration with other teachers. And that's part of your expectations and your job. And they give you the time to do it.
You know, because teachers are the best resources for ideas, and it's lovely. So anything mm-hmm. I can do to collaborate, it's really meaningful for me. But it would be ideal if, we, of course, this is the dream world. We hire other teachers or specialists, take students for the afternoon and give them something special. And, of course, teachers get together during that time to talk out things. How's it going? That would be spending more money, though. And as you know, that's not what we can do right now.
Yeah.
But that's the ideal.
Matt, do you have any, have you come across any venues or forums where teachers are exchanging information, obviously not able to be right next to each other, but that have you seen cases of where this kind of dialogue can happen online that might be helpful?
Yeah, I think just trying to find some of these opportunities for where a university like one of ours, we host a Saturday workshop every couple of weeks, every couple of months to get people together from all over our area And, you know, it's all on Zoom, of course, but it's really just a rapid fire sharing. And, you know, we've done different formats, but in one of those, everybody had, I think, 7 minutes to share something cool about what they had. And we went from, I forget if it was from 9 to noon or something like that, and took no breaks, but people would just step away when they needed to. But it was amazing to have that opportunity just to hear a little snip from somebody else's experiences of what worked for them. And so trying to find those sorts of things, we see a lot of appetite for these short one-off experiences that we in the past always said, oh, that's not the way to bring about change. That's not the way to, you need to invest in long-term relationships in your professional development. But right now, nobody got time for no long-term relationships. We are just barely keeping our head. And if we can just find one little thing to get that brief dose, if you will, of interactions. And so I know that there are a number of places. I bet the Exploratorium has those periodically as well.
Yeah, they had one this weekend, and it was really interesting. It's about the underrepresentation of minorities, you know, and how in science, specifically what we're going to do about it. Really interesting, you know, and it gives you an idea. You go, oh, and you know, it just, the teachers are really good about, oh, I never thought of it that way. And then we research it more, whatever. It's great to have new ideas. I talked about this before, but I love Twitter. And it's not like there are so many great science teachers out there that share ideas. And then I retweet them. It's my way of adding, you know, and there's so many good people out there. There are teachers, there are scientists, there's a combination. And people share their links. They share their materials. It's all for free. And we share it with other, you know, and it seems to be really, okay, that might work. And that, I think, is the best way to go about this. I mean, I would love more time.
We will share your Twitter handle with our on our podcast so that, and I'm not even sure that I follow you, Elizabeth. So now I know exactly what I'll do a little bit later. So I agree, it is a great resource. I just wanted to ask you a couple other questions. You know, you've been a supporter of Green Ninja for many years, and then this year you're actually using it. So what elements of, I'm kind of curious, what elements of the curriculum have helped you in this remote learning? And then what else could we do at Green Ninja to help you over the next coming weeks and months so that we can better support you and your students?
I think, as Matt mentioned, choosing maybe different phenomena, I'm not sure, something that they can do at home that would probably be more helpful, more pictures, or ask us to get more pictures. I look for ways to use the Google Slides, which are very good, but trying to get students more involved. You know, right now they're writing on the slide, or I've tried Nearpod or Pear Deck. There are those two programs that you can use for free that gives some interactivity. I use Edpuzzle because my students cannot see videos. And with Edpuzzle, you kind of cushion the video and you can pose questions. So it's a combination. To me, it's really discussion doesn't work very well at this point, or at least the way I'm teaching. They've got to be doing something. So I like, especially, I was doing things about the layer of iridium, you know, in the asteroid in the past. I said, move the red star, you know, move this around, move that around. I mean, ideally, it'd be some video game and then get it. You know, any more games we could give them would be great. That really works, but I know how hard that is. Anything that they can do interactively and get immediate feedback. So, for example, you know, there's the variety of even free quizzes. There's quizzes, literally Kahoot, many more, and they get feedback right away. And that can be very empowering. Also, I've given Google Forms as a quiz. Open it up so they see the answers and they take the quiz again to kind of reinforce what they didn't get right. And they get the immediate satisfaction of getting them all right. So anything that gives them immediate feedback can help. So I'm looking at Green Ninja. I'm adding a little bit to it too. But I mean, the science is really profound and kids are getting used to that idea. And I'm telling them, you know, we need to work on the world, because if you decide to have kids, you want your kids to be okay. You know, and that's, they're pretty family oriented as a goal. So as interactive as it can be, I'm always looking for anything that they could touch, move around, and get feedback on.
Good advice, definitely.
Yeah, not easy to do though.
And Matt was hearing one of the chapters that I think he actually helped develop with the Iridium.
I love it. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth, you've shared a lot of resources. I'm imagining that there's some listeners who are not practicing teachers. So we'll try to share some of those. But I think that you, at least at the overall level, you've shared with us the situation that you're in about students wanting, you know, this more immediate feedback. And I've heard that actually, we heard that from some other mm-hmm. colleagues of ours. And we are trying to take that to heart to try to make this learning experience as interactive and engaging as possible. And we will continue to support you and as we continue to develop additional materials, we'll show you and see, hey, what do you think about this? And, you know, I think that's how we all learn. And you have your finger on the pulse of what's out there too, which I think is really helpful. So I want to thank you for joining us today and really enjoyed hearing about the challenges and then some of the things you're trying. And it does sound like your students are starting to get used to it, but I know that we know that this is really hard. It's not an easy thing for anyone to try to do, and especially in some of our communities where the parents have lots of responsibilities and other things going on as well. We know that's especially hard. So please feel free to reach out to us when there's anything else we can do or you have some ideas. We're happy to talk.
Hey, I've got one more thing, and then I'll let you go, okay?
Sure.
What I've been doing on the more difficult slides that kids are reading, I will use the teacher slide set and cover over the answers. So if students don't know what we're going for, they can slide that box out of the way and see, quote, an answer. And that gives them something. So I'm using that as a stopgap. Teachers did a wonderful job of putting in answers. So that really is helpful. And that makes it easier, I gotta say. So we'll work up to it.
That instant feedback that you're talking about, finding some way to get it to the students so that they can, you know, in this environment when we're not there in the classroom with them, we gotta find all these other ways. That's
right.
A good suggestion.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, that does help. So thank you. I've really enjoyed this.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. And thanks for being a retired teacher who decided I'm not going to go retire quite yet and go back.
Can't do it. Yeah. And it's been fun. Again, I love using the Green Ninja. I'm really excited to keep moving with it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for sharing. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now we turn our attention to climate change and the environment, where we review some of the latest news in this area and talk about how to bring such topics into our classroom. So, Matt, I'm going to tell you a quick story about an event that I attended last week called 10,000 Teachers that aimed to get 10,000 teachers to commit to teaching climate change in the classroom. The organizer of this event, it was really, I don't know, did you hear about that at all?
I'm afraid I didn't. So obviously I didn't make it this far, but you can add one more.
Yeah, there we go. So the organizer of the event is this guy named Chuck Nice, and he's actually a stand-up comedian and co-host of Star Talk, a podcast with Neil deGrasse Tyson. The event was really fun, and I was one of the presenters who spoke with moderators about our work on education and climate change. But there were a lot of other interesting folks who were there, and I thought I'd just share a little bit about this event with you and with our audience here, because I think it's so interesting. So probably the best known scientist who were there was Catherine Hayhoe, who is on Twitter a lot, and she's getting lots of press in terms of talking to different audiences. But I really enjoyed the discussion with New Jersey First Lady Tammy Snyder Murphy. And she was talking about how in New Jersey, they had the opportunity to change their standards recently. And what she helped work on, and the governor, was bringing climate change into all of the standards throughout K-12. And she was so proud that that had happened. So Matt, you know, can you share with us, you know, what would that look like if you were to teach all subjects in K-12 and that it required some element of having climate change in there? I want to try to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, well, I think it would actually be brilliantly easy, actually, because climate change touches all aspects of our lives. And so in our educational system, of course, we can conceive of math and science. It's sort of what we talk a lot about in our everyday lives. But things from English language arts in terms of our reading our resources and learning how to read and learning how to get useful information from nonfiction. That's part of Common Core. So that's not too far of a stretch, but thinking now about all sorts of other fields, everything, social studies, you know, what's the role of government in protecting people from climate change? Thinking about looking at case studies where you're looking at the role of the legislative branch or the executive branch or the judicial branches in climate policy and what sort of how that actually works. My daughter's learning right now about, you know, the different parts of the California state government, and you can really see, you know, there are place opportunities that even in fourth grade they could start talking about. What has California done that's been really amazingly innovative on climate as a government? And there's so much there. But going back, there's literature, there's poetry, and how do we express our feelings and our fears? That's a big part of things. Art, look at the music, there's sonification of climate data. I don't know if you've ever seen the 1 minute climate symphony. That's always a fun thing to play and listen to. Visual arts, there's great examples of amazing modern art that's done that sort of evokes feelings about climate change that helps communicate. Mm-hmm. There's a melting wax sculpture that was in Orlando that I thought was really just brilliant, sort of this sculpture that's transient and going away as climate change. There's people that have put sea level markers up at their schools trying to show if sea level rises a few feet, we'll be, it'll be here on our school building. School strike for climate protest poster art. You've got the visual arts at CSUN at our campus. We have our performance ensemble, which does social justice activism through movement. And they really just, I can imagine them doing great things on the issue of climate and just really trying to communicate all of the different aspects from taking data and illustrating and depicting that through dance to taking the feelings that we have. There's so much there. And it's just, like I said, climate change really, it does touch us in so many ways that our curriculum could and perhaps should be moving towards really digging into those issues more deeply.
Well, one of the outcomes of this 10,000 teacher event was to encourage your local legislators to do something similar, to include more climate change education. Could you see this happening in California, Matt?
I mean, things go really slowly, having seen that process of how quickly things are getting adopted at the statewide level. And of course, the state doesn't actually get to dictate curriculum, and our curriculum is pretty broad, our standards are pretty broad in what they actually require. They never specify a topic that one must discuss, more about skills and practices and things like that. So it could happen, but it's... We just finished reviewing several of those standards, and the next time that we're going to be getting a chance to dig into those and make big changes is not for a number of years. So slow progress on the official transition, but of course, every teacher is enabled to actually pick these things up on their own and provide the resources to them to help them along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a question that I have for you as well, is that so the event was really fun. I invite people to go to the website. If you just Google 10,000 teachers in climate, you'll find it. There was scientists, but there was folks who were thinking about neuropsychology, or there was some music. There was some other artists. And so it was a nice combination. I think I was really impressed that there were people from all over the world. When you look at the chat, from all over the world who care about climate, and they were educators. So now the question that some of us are asking ourselves is, what's next? Like, how else can we support, or how can we take this enthusiasm and turn it into action in the classroom? So Matt, what do you think? I mean, this is a theme that we've had here on the show before, but what could we as an organization, at this 10,000 teachers, how could we help this really broad segment of folks from around the world who have an interest in doing something? What can we offer them?
Well, there's everything from the ideas, trying to give them some specific entry points, to really producing curriculum for them. That's always what teachers are trying to get, something that is ready for them to use in the classroom so they don't have to do all the work themselves. And that's kind of the direction I would think that we could go. But you could start with things like providing economics curriculum, having a unit that you could have ready to go about the economics of climate change, cost-benefit analysis of energy choices, economic analysis of the Green New Deal, labor rights, globalization, social cost of carbon. You could spend some time on providing some sort of a ready-made unit that people could draw from in each one of the subject areas. And that would probably be the starting point that I would have, thinking about each grade band and each sort of topic area.
Sounds like fun.
It's a big undertaking.
It is a big undertaking. Well, let's now shift to our final segment where we talk about burritos and everything related to burritos. So Matt, I'm going to ask you, I know you do some gardening. Do you have anything in the garden right now?
I just this morning pulled out my corn, which is dried stalks right now, and I'm getting ready to put in a autumn winter garden here.
So can you tell me, when is corn in season for you?
We had our probably about a month ago, I think, everything, our ears of corn were all set and ready to eat, although admittedly some night animal one night ate all 30 something ears of corn on my patches all in one night, about 2 days before I was planning on harvesting. So
You're kidding. Oh no.
No.
Oh gosh. We stopped growing corn for that reason. You know, in our garden, one of my favorite times of the year is when our peaches are in season. We have about two or three weeks when they're there. So my question to you is, when is the best season for eating burritos?
Wow. Well, I think that probably to make that burrito really pop, you want to have some really great fresh tomato salsa. And so you'll need to be having some nice fresh tomatoes, which down here in Southern California have a pretty broad seasonal range. Throughout much of the spring, summer, and fall, depending upon how good your tomato plants are. But that's what I want to have, is that fresh tomato salsa.
Yeah, that reminds me that at the local grocery store, there is a provider of some kind of salsa fresca. It's called Casa Sanchez. And I really notice the difference between the summertime salsa. It's all packaged. Doesn't look like there's any difference. But in the winter, it just doesn't taste very... It's not a very rich flavor. And then sometimes in the summer, it's delicious. So yeah, that salsa or the tomatoes in your burrito really can have a seasonality to it. So I do think that that's interesting. And I'll be honest with you, I've not thought about that before until I started to kind of connect more recently, like, oh, the ingredients, you know, may vary. So maybe there is a season for burritos, but I will admit to you that I seem to eat them all year round, no matter what.
Year round burrito eater.
Yeah. So, but maybe I'm enjoying some flavors more than others. And maybe in the fall and winter, we'll be putting more squash and other things in them. So.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good place for us to stop. Thanks for joining us at Ask Matt, where we explore NGSS, science education, and the environment with education expert and nice guy, Matthew DeLacio. Thanks for being here tonight, Matt.
Yay, absolutely. Thank you. It's a good conversation, especially with Elizabeth here.
Yeah, she was great. Okay, see you next time.
Bye-bye.